Geek Radio Daily takes another look at Mysticon. This time, I get the honor of hosting the Cheryl and Finn Q&A panel from Sunday morning. So get ready for a very informative and completely honest talk with the one and only Ms. Cheryl and Finn.
Please, ladies and gentlemen, would you give a huge round of applause to Ms. Cheryl and Finn. Thank you.
I think they were partying outside my hotel room. It was like three. I was like, wow. Thank God I brought a fan.
Oh, you can't do it without that, so you can't. All right, so of course, Q&A we're going to do. Of course, we'll get to everyone's questions because I know everyone's thrilled. First off, I have to be honest. Mysticon, year after year, keeps putting me on a Q&A, which I am very, very happy for. But they keep putting me on Q&As with people I've had mad crushes on. So I'm going to try not to just... I'm going to be professional about this.
Go ahead and let us squeeze now.
Oh, my God. I'm here with Cheryl and Finn. Oh my God! Okay.
You're
okay.
So sweet.
Okay. The bubble is burst.
I mean, you know, we were.
She's taking your cherry.
Oh, you know, I practiced the cherry trick myself a long time. You inspired me on so many levels. I'm pretty good.
It takes time.
It does. You have to be patient and giving, which is good for anybody. Been a lot of things in your life. You've got a varied career. It's an interesting and it's fascinating. I'm not going to dwell on it too much because I know everybody wants to ask it themselves, but because you were so tied into something with such mystery and such conspiracy that we'll never, ever solve, I was wondering if you could tell me from the bottom of your heart, do you believe The Wild Life is a sequel to Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Oh, totally.
There it is. Cameron Crowe wrote both the movies Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Absolutely.
And The Wild Life. And if you look, if you want to draw it out, you like conspiracy theories, very possible that movie's a sequel.
Well, and Sean and his brother Christopher was in it, you know, who was my boyfriend at the time. And yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
That's outstanding. Because Ben Stein sort of accidentally started this rumor on a Ferris Bueller commentary track, if you will, where he mentions that The Wild Life, since it's written, is a direct sequel to Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And since that time, people have gone out of their way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for confirming that. I do like that.
My pleasure.
Now, so because everyone just, you know, people get stuck in Twin Peaks, they get stuck in Two Moon Junction, they get stuck in everything, they forget that you are one of the iconic 80s people. Every tentpole, everything is right there because just one of the guys seeing this movie, of course. Who is the incredible woman in it? Right here. She's not one of the guys. She can't be. You can't masculine this up.
Come in.
Do it. Do it. We're friendly folks. We are friendly.
I was Sandy the fish girl.
Did you ever at any moment forget that Terry wasn't a guy?
Totally. Look, she made the cutest guy ever. She looked darling as a boy. I mean, I was like, yes, she was good as a boy. Yeah. We had fun.
I mean, you know, she looked like the Karate Kid, dressed like Elvis Costello. Absolutely.
She was darling.
I tried my best. I was like, well, if that's what works, but I don't look anything like the Karate Kid. But I tried in my own horrible 80s way to make it.
To me, she was a cuter boy than a girl. So, you know, but I could have just been in character.
You know, that explains a lot about me now. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. That does make a lot of sense. On Throwback Thursdays, have you ever thought about recreating all of the outfits from Thrashin'?
No, but it would be fun.
That would be fun.
I mean, most of those clothes were mine, you know.
Really? That's the old personal collection?
Yeah, a lot of vintage stuff and like that little white bra thing.
Yeah.
My little thing. My glasses. And yeah, that was a lot of my own stuff. That was
skateboarding
fun.
Movies. They don't really happen anymore. They try to be serious now. Like Lords of Dogtown and stuff. They've done serious, like, look back retrospectives. Thrashing. James Brolin?
James Brolin.
Josh Brolin. It wasn't his dad. His dad was not in it.
Yeah. My best friend, Pamela Gidley, was in it, and Robert Ressler. And then there were a lot of, actual professional skateboarders. And it was crazy. I was shooting in this old house, and they're on the roof. I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? But it was just, it was a really fun time shooting that.
Oh, it's a good time. And if you can ever find the soundtrack, you are not going to be disappointed. So you could,
yeah, Red Hot Chili Peppers. They played live at this at the concert scene or the club scene. I guess it was. Yeah.
It's so weird. It's a fantastic little time capsule, and you see this, and especially now Red Hot Chili Peppers everywhere in the world. To see them is just they're just the band here at the club. Mm-hmm. It's weird, man. It's weird in that good way. Another one classic that sticks out for so many reasons. You were in The Wraith. Has everyone seen The Wraith? Tell me you've... Thank you. Of course. Now, no matter what the director and creator says, The Crow did not rip off this movie. It did not. I understand there's thematical similarities to it. This was a very difficult shoot from what I understand. Because the wonderful lakeside scene that looks so beautiful, how cold was it on that scene?
That was really cold. It was also difficult for other reasons because Charlie was being Charlie. And Charlie was being Charlie in his 20s, which was really bad. And I love him as a person, but, they're going to Las Vegas, the guys, and coming back for 5 a.m., calls where they can't even say their lines. And I was the identifiable problem because I was young. So they could say, it's Sherilyn. She's too green. She's too new. We need to get her a coach. I'm like, he doesn't even know his lines. Like, how am I the problem? But again, I was the identifiable problem because nobody was going to blame Charlie for doing what Charlie was doing. Because that's kind of what Hollywood does. They let a lot of shit slide. a really sad example is the film that Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix did, and
My Own Private Idaho.
Yeah.
Oh, duh. Thank you. Right.
Where he was introduced to heroin, and ultimately it killed him. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, so the rumor goes that Keanu was back then having issues with heroin and the studio was supplying him with clean syringes.
Whoa.
Because, hey, they got to get that movie made.
Wow. Okay.
So that's, there's a really ugly underbelly to Hollywood of people bowing at the altar of money. And those were some pretty ugly stories. Rumors. I can't verify them. Nobody coming to me. But I knew as makeup artists, I knew people directly involved going like, when clean syringes are being delivered, something's really wrong. Okay. So to a much lesser degree, that's kind of, I would get blamed in The Wraith at the fact that the guys were in Las Vegas all weekend partying and they can't say their lines, but Sherilyn needs a coach. Like, okay. So, and somebody got killed on that film. I mean, I hate to, this is just the truth. They were doing a special effects shot of the car and they had, they inappropriately and unsafely had a camera crew on the back of a flatbed, not an enclosed truck with walls, right, to keep them safe, a flatbed, filming the car, and it flipped. And someone died, and someone was then paralyzed from the waist down. In my opinion, it ain't worth it. It's a movie. It's about human beings. They're more important than your movie. What town am I living in?
Right.
So so there's weird experiences and memories around The Wraith for me.
Because of difficulties of all this and people out late like that, I mean, The Wraith has like this weird dreamlike quality to it to begin with.
Mm.
And I can't say that I believe that was intentional. Mm-hmm. Was that just a coming together of everything?
I personally think God has a hand in everything. Everything. And maybe that's maybe that is why it had that quality. I mean, they did things like I wasn't supposed to have nudity and they moved the camera where Charlie was supposed to be blocking me to get my breast in when it was just like people, you're like, really? Really? Like integrity, does it exist? You have to fight for it. And when you're a young actress, which I was very young, I was 19, And, you know, and then I would have costume designers or my friends coming and warning me, oh, my gosh, we saw dailies. They did it. They did move the camera. Just crazy, crazy stuff. You know, you don't do this to people. In your regular 9-to-5 job, you don't have to worry someone's going to move the camera to get your breast in it. You know?
It's like, unfortunately, no. I'm
really an honest, straightforward person. And I could sit here and be like, oh, just all so amazing. And, you know, but there has been amazing circumstances and amazing times with people that had integrity, and then there's oftentimes not. And as a young actress, you've got to be smart, you got to be on top of it, you've got to protect yourself, even when an entire set will turn on you, and they will. They'll turn on you if you don't want to take your top off, and they'll say, well, she did it in another scene. And it's like, well, we're not, that was another day, that was another movie, that's where I agreed to do it. It doesn't mean I'm doing it here, because you have an international thing that you want to call my agent crying in a phone booth. They're all mad at me. Carry on.
So Charlie couldn't remember his lines because you kept your top on too much? Is that how this goes?
No, Charlie couldn't remember his lines because he had gone out and partied. He took a jet with a bunch of the guys. They went to Las Vegas for the night. When we're in the middle of production, hello, professionality. So, you know, I'm in bed. I'm learning lines. I'm excited. I have one of my first leads. And we came back and they were not difficult lines, okay? We're not quoting Shakespeare. Okay, it's like, Carrie, do you want to go to the dance, Carrie? I can't remember the line. It was crazy. So they stopped production, and that cost money. So I'm the one to blame.
Wow.
They didn't say, well, Charlie went and got drunk in Vegas all weekend and came back and couldn't say his lines. They said, we need to get Cheryl and find a coach because she's too green.
That's sucker.
So, you know, you survive it all. It's all good, but it's laughable, you know. And now all these years later with winning and all this stuff comes up, and I'm like, oh, baby, you weren't winning back then. They pretended you were, but, you know.
Well, perception's reality or something like that.
Something.
The movie Ruby gave you a chance to do something I don't think I'd ever actually seen in a movie before. Did you get a chance to sing? Where's the album? Where did this ever go?
Oh, God, I never want to do an album. My mom and her family, they all sing. They all play instruments. My aunt is well-known in Europe. Her name's Susie Quattro, and she's had a career there for forever. They all had an all-girl band when I was a child called the Pleasure Seekers. How embarrassing is that? So that just came along in between the first and second season of Twin Peaks. And I love Marilyn Monroe, and I saw that as an opportunity to kind of do an homage to Marilyn. Because it was kind of loosely based on her and some of the other, there weren't actresses, but there were other women that were kind of, you know, I'm not even sure what their title was, but they were very beautiful and they hung out with the gangsters. There's that some of them have written books, some of them have, you know, none on the scale of Marilyn, but this one in particular whose name eludes me. And, yeah, so that was my opportunity to shed light on that story because I personally believe that he was absolutely, you know, killed. And for very, you know, because he was powerful, because he wanted to change America, because he went against the gangsters that put him into office, basically. I mean, I just believe all that. So for me, it was really, I was really, really excited to be a part of it in a period piece. And yeah, the dancing was scary. It was sort of like an exorcism because it was. Because I'm not real into being eye candy, and I felt it was scary. And then I heard Danny Aiello on the phone, like, inviting his friends down. Yeah, she's going to be stripping, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, seriously? So I like freaked out and called my manager and everybody. And even though what she stripped down to was a very modest 1960s, you know, a very big bottom bikini, totally covering. But it was still, you know, as a woman, it was, you know, what is the goal of being eye candy? Nothing. You know, if you haven't got a soul or you haven't got a mind or you haven't, you know, got more to give, it just doesn't really matter. Right before the scene, I was like literally freaking out, and I called my teacher, he's the best teacher ever, who passed away, Roy London, God bless him. But he said, Carolyn, let's change the triad. He said, you're dancing in front of people, a lot of men that are terminally ill. They're going to pass, and this is the joy they'll get. And I'm like, okay, bye. And I just, and then it was easy. Then it was like, okay, get that made sense to my heart, to my spirit, to my soul. So then I could go and do the scenes, the first one in particular, and enjoy it. And I made sure Danny kept all of his freaky fans out because I'm not a stripper there. You know what I mean? Like, it's a job. How dare you? So inappropriate. But this is the guy who thought he could call me at 11 p.m. at night and be like, want to come over and rehearse? I'm like, no, you know, who have you worked with? You know, no, sorry. And, but again, I'm brutally honest. I get in trouble, but I don't care because this is my truth and this is my direct experience with things that happen. And I'm in the process of writing a memoir and they all going to be sorry.
Well, when that gets turned into a movie... Who's going to play you?
Jennifer Goodwin.
Okay. Nice. We can take that.
Now, only because she comes on TV and my 9-year-old goes, Mommy, that's you. I'm like, no, it's not. Mommy, that's you. I'm like, Christian, look at me. That is not me. This is an actress. Huh. Mommy, it's you. You just don't remember. I'm like, okay, so she looks enough like me that she could play me, or, you know. Just someone that had heart, I would say. Someone that had soul. Someone that had intelligence.
I guess that explains my crush on Jennifer Goodwin, too. Okay, then. Now, you are an actor. I'm a person who's just been in some acting things. Mm-hmm. So, not that we'll even pretend to ever understand this craft, but one of the most amazing things in my mind you've ever done is boxing Helena.
Mm.
How do you make yourself believe you don't have arms and legs? How do you make yourself emote the way you did with just your face without it being this cartoon that people like to do in pictures with screwing their face up overly exaggerated?
You work in Hollywood for 20 years. I mean, seriously.
And you don't go to Vegas. You don't take the chartered plane to L.A.
Well, I wasn't into it. I mean, it's just not what I was into. Boxing Helena was amazing. First of all, David Lynch's daughter wrote it and directed it. She wrote it when she was 19 years old. By the time the script got to me, Kim Basinger had already chickened out, basically. She had agreed to do the movie. They literally started building sets. This is not a big production. And all of a sudden she's like, oh, sorry, not doing it. And cost them millions of dollars. And Ed Harris, an amazing actor, was on board as well because he saw that the film had something really special to say. And then it went on to Madonna. And as I'm happy to say, thank God she didn't do it, because not a fan of her acting at all. She's not an actress. And I mean, she's a great performer, but she's not an actress. And just because you're a performer doesn't mean you're an actress. And just because you're an actor doesn't mean you're a musician. I mean, it's like we get it all mixed up. It's like somewhere in the ego section, they think they can do it all. And most of the time, they can't. If they can, it's amazing. Maybe some can, but very few are good actors and good musicians. So then she dropped out, thank God for Jennifer. And then the script came to me, and I'd heard the gossip that people had heard about it or said about it. And I'd met Jennifer only briefly once on the set with David, and was just kind of jealous because she was David's daughter and I loved David. And it was like stupid. I was so immature. So then I read and my manager said, just read the script. Just read it from beginning to end, and then we'll talk. Because she knows my taste, which is a little different. So I read it, and I threw it across the room, and I was really angry and really upset, and I knew I had to do it. And you know, when I'm afraid of something, that is a good signal to me that I will grow from doing it, that I have something to learn here, that it's triggering things that I, you know, don't want to look at sometimes, which is the absolute reason to look at them and to do them, because that's how you grow. You don't grow sticking your head in the sand. My eyes, as a shrink used to say, you know, people, they stick their head in the sand and they think they're all protected, but their ass is up in the air. Everybody can see him, and they're completely a target. But you think you're all safe in that little city. No, and you're not. Someone wise said an unexamined life is not worth living. You know, if you're tormented, it's probably because you're not looking at the things in your life, the ways that you were hurt, the stories that messed you up, the people that betrayed you, that you're not looking at them. You grab the monster out the kit, you pull it, you look at it, you see what it is, you acknowledge it, and then it's not so strong anymore. So again, by the grace of God, Roy London, an amazing teacher, taught me that. So the next step was to actually meet Jennifer, and we talked for, I don't even know, like 4 hours. Coffee. And I knew she was my sister, and I knew that I loved her, and I knew that I had to work with her.
Boxing Aline is another one of these films that there are people that have never heard of this, or people that know you are like, what? That's just weird. A guy that's going to, he did what to a woman to keep her? And but what they miss is this amazing story that you have. And there's this moment.
Don't tell the end.
I'm not going to tell the end. But there is an amazing moment you have to watch. And it's what I'm talking about. I am a very expressive person. And it's the hardest thing for me, especially on auditions, to not just flail my hands all around. She has this moment in this movie where it is, I am completely vulnerable. I am completely caught up in you. And in the course of a conversation with just subtle movements, turns the whole thing around as it's in charge. It is this amazing scene. And I have always loved
which
that.
Scene?
When you're sitting on the bed.
For the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to see that. Now, a moment ago, you were in the signing room, and the master of ceremonies, my good friend in podcasting's Rich Siegfried, was talking to you and mentioned, and he's a jerk for doing this, but he mentioned Fatal Instinct. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned Fatal Instinct, but he did not ask the question that he wanted me to ask you directly.
Mm-hmm.
He would like for me to ask you, what does Powers Booth smell like? I know. That's why he didn't ask you.
I have no idea.
And I was like, dude, what the hell kind of, how am I supposed to ask her? And he's like, well, I just always had the feeling, because he's so cool. I get this sandalwood and leather image. And I'm like, why are you thinking about that? Is that the character's name? No, I'm sorry, not Powers Booth. Armand Asante.
Oh, for goodness.
I always get Armand Asante and Powers Booth goofed. I don't know why I do.
That's okay. He smells fine. He smells like cologne, actually. He's a very into himself, clean guy. But let's go back. I just remember Boxing Elena. So Boxing Elena, who doesn't know? Woman, man, anybody, being seen in a box. They see you a specific way. They don't let you out of that way. It makes them feel comfortable. Oh, she does, he does, And they know maybe that much of you. So as a woman in Hollywood, you can, you know, the amount of boxes that you get put in are ridiculous. You're supposed to be in a creative business with creative people, but there's only a handful of creative people. The other people want to say, she is la, 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 and put you on the shelf so that then they go down their grocery aisle of actors. No, she's there. He's there. They don't know you. So the idea of being in a box, period, was powerful to me because I'd been in a box my whole life. The idea of also, this is a kind of a scary fairy tale about what obsessive relationships really do to us, ourselves, to our insides, okay? What she did was found a way to demonstrate that because you can, how do you demonstrate, how do you illustrate inside wounds? By putting them on the outside. I will say to you, if you haven't seen the film, there is no violence in the film. There is no blood in the film. The film is not a horror film. But it will get under your skin and it will make you uncomfortable because of the things that she addresses psychologically and then illustrates them physically. Again, no, he puts her in, do any of you ultimately know what it's about?
Yes or no?
Okay, so if you go to see the film, right, and you type it up, it will say it's a film about a man that takes off a woman's arms and legs.
Yeah.
That's what it'll say. Now, she's put in a box like a jewel, like a diamond in a beautiful, like the most beautiful diamond ring in a beautiful box with lace and silk around it. And David Copperfield was the illusionist who made her look like she was, you know, really in there. I still have my limbs. I'm okay. It's a movie. since movies in the world tends to like to dumb things down and really disrespects the intelligence of people, they presented it that way. That's not what it is. It is the things that we do to each other in relationships, be they obsessive or not, because they can turn obsessive really quick if someone doesn't want you anymore. All of a sudden, that is the person that you needed for your entire, you know, we get crazy. And it connects back to your childhood, as everything does. The lead had a mother who rejected him. So when he meets Helena, who rejects him, he thinks she has to be the one and does whatever he can to go after her. No blood, no surgeries. You see nothing, but what you feel is pretty intense. It's pretty intense.
It's not an easy ride. It's an amazing ride, but it is not an easy ride.
And what I love about the film is people either love it or they hate it. And I'm like, fine. I would rather you have a reaction than no reaction. And I'm not here to do everything that all of you like so that you like and love me, you know? Because at 52, I love me. I'm proud of the things that I've done. There's certain things I had to do for money that I'm like, oh, not so proud of. But for the most part, I lay my head down at night. I'm true to my God, Lord Jesus. I'm happy. I'm cool. I don't want it. See, there's a pyramid. And up here at the top of the pyramid, y'all are being brainwashed by movies they want you to see. They don't want you to see a movie that's going to make you think. They don't want you to see a movie that's going to empower you. They want you to be consuming and buying, drinking alcohol, smoking cigarettes, and buying the clothes and the food or the whatever, however they make their money. It's not about empowerment in this world. That's my boxing thing.
The marketing aspect is one of the strangest things I learned as a kid. Back to the Future of all places, when Marty comes back to 1984, there's a homeless man sitting on a bench, and it never occurred to me that the California Raisins Company paid to have their name on that bench. I just thought stuff was there.
Oh,
I just thought stuff was there. That
product
was my eye-opening.
Placement. Also in that movie, there's huge Coca-Cola machines and, you know, all of that product placement, big money in films, product placement. And a funny thing is that a big regret of M&M's will be that the E.T. wanted to use M&M's to be the things that they get to come. And they said, no. Reese's Pieces, you fool. You know, now they're sorry.
Yeah, that's a thing now. Reese's, who knew that before? My goodness. So were you more of a Dawson fan or a Pacey fan?
God, I didn't even know the show that well.
Oh, really? So you had no problem being impartial on the set then?
No, I didn't. I didn't. Well, Pacey was who I had my scenes with, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I liked him more.
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah, I liked him more.
Joshua Jackson.
Yeah. He's great. He was really, really great. Yeah. I mean, they were all great, but I liked him for sure.
No, he seemed like he was not being the absolute star of the show, not having the show named after you and the creek named after you has to be easier to be an actual character instead of living up to that valued name, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You always have to worry about being liked and all that kind of stuff.
Now, you have made me watch things I never thought I would in my life simply because you were in it.
Uh-oh.
I really have to know, how in the world did you end up in a prequel to The Dukes of Hazzard?
Oh, because a dear friend of mine was the director who came. I did a show, one of Showtime's first shows, called Rude Awakening. And I did 3 seasons of it. And it was about a young woman who, and it was based on Claudia Lennau's life, where she was acting since she was like 16. She was in Knott's Landing playing, I think, Michelle Lee's daughter. And by the time she was like 21, she was an alcohol, like waking up, slamming shots of tequila, blowing, just every kind of bad thing you can imagine. And this is no secret. This is her story. She shares this. And then she got sober. And when she got sober, she got crazier even than when she was drunk and stuff, she says. And her whole life got really, 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 really amazing. And so one of my favorite, and it's a comedy, but it's a black comedy. It's not like Friends. We're all perfect. We're all so funny. We all do everything right. We're all so thin. not a Friends fan, although I did do an episode, but I had a wooden leg and it was great. It was great. I wasn't like the normal Friends girl. So one of my favorite directors on Rude Awakening was Bobby Berlinger. And he was such a great, you know, comic director. So he just called and said, do you want to do this role? It's really funny. And it's, you know, you like making a turkey and all this stuff. And I was like, let's go. It sounds like fun. And I love Bobby Berlinger. So I did it. And
take
I probably had to pay rent too. Let's face it. I mean, I'm a single mom, two kids. I don't have family that's ever paid my bills. I don't have anybody that pays my bills. And sometimes I have to do things to pay my bills.
And then sometimes you get to take on the role of an iconic character like Lulu Hogg. So yes, if you have not
seen Lulu Hogg, she was fun too.
Every scene lights up.
She had big hair and she's a Lulu. She's making this turkey and slapping it.
The turkey is comedic gold. I tell you, every scene that you're in, it's like it's a whole other movie because you like, I don't know, we're supposed to be having this kind of fun. And I'm not sure the entire cast understood that.
Lulu came in and look out.
Absolutely.
But we all have Lulus in our life, don't we? Aren't they bright lights? And, you know, you might sort of mock them, but I'm going to tell you something. When they pass, you're going to remember those Lulus because those are real, authentic people. They're fun. They're silly. They're not like, oh, I have to be I have to fit in and be who everybody wants me to be and make sure I'm the white out. You know, come on.
You're going to
live.
Cry. You're going to cry the next time the turkey comes around and it wasn't Lulu's. It happens.
I just remember the slapping it. Slapping that turkey. What is going on? Lulu, calm down.
So you weren't really a Dawson's fan before getting on there. Were you a fan of Shameless before coming to the crew?
Well, I was a fan of William H. Macy. I hadn't seen the show. And I became a huge fan, especially all the kids. I love the kids on that show. I love them so much. All of them are really, really special, hardworking, unique creatures. The kids are my favorite thing about the show, especially my little Chucky, who plays my little my grandson. And he's got, you know, he's a special one. He's like the most disruptive on the set, but he's my favorite because they'll be like, I'm not going to do this or whatever. And they'll be, stop it. And I'll be like, just, you know, chill. He's cool. Come here, Chucky. You know, like, he's just a great, 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 great kid. And they're, you know, they're pace. I mean, I've never been on a show that shoots things so fast. So it was a little, it was hard that way. If somebody had said, as soon as you walk on the set, before you even rehearse, they're going to be filming, then I would have been prepared.
Wow.
You know, okay. So, but it's like, ready. And somebody else was fired, so they brought me on, so I didn't ever get a chance to block out my scenes. It was like, you're going to stand here, say that, go there, do that, go there, dude, go, and go, shoot. And I was just like, wow. Okay. So I did my best. I had a good time doing it.
Yeah, oh, obviously.
And I dyed my hair platinum because I was certain, like, a bunch of my hair is coming in really white. And I thought, I bet if it would just all come in white. And, of course, it didn't. Of course, half of it's still dark. So I'm, like, then bleaching my hair, losing my mind, so I went dark again. It was cool because I bleached it, and then I got a cool job. So it worked out.
Outstanding. Now, could you tell us about your book? Because, I don't know, you can get a T-shirt. You can get an autographed picture. You can get the deal of the day, the T-shirt and the picture for the $50 together. But there's a book there that's got your name on it.
Yeah, I hand-painted these T-shirts for Twin Peaks, and it's really fun. I love them. But the book that I wrote is called No Man's Land, and it's a published book. And it's a children's book because my youngest is on the autism spectrum. The autism spectrum to me basically is this new species of kids that are coming in that are amazingly creative and powerful and beautiful. How did it come into being? I used to always say to my son, are we in no man's land? Because whatever I said, he'd say, no. You know, even like, you know, do you want a popsicle? No. And then he'd take it. I'm like, okay. Everything is no. And so... It introduces him to, and also as a parent, if your child doesn't fit into the box, they're labeled. They're labeled really quickly. You know, that's a whole other conversation. I mean, the educational system is an absolute mess. It wants to create soldiers. It does not want to embrace individuals. No children are the same. No children learn the same. There is not something wrong with your child if they learn different. And to be told something's wrong with them is devastating. It's the same pyramid that is trying to get everybody scared and consuming. Okay. They do something in the hospital that's interesting. I had my first baby at home with a midwife. My second, I was like, I want no pain, none, zero, zilch, done nothing. Okay. So, but they do this thing where they put a fetal monitor on you. Okay. The fetal monitor after, and they do it to see, to make sure that your baby is not in distress. Great. So it monitors the heart rate. Well, what they don't tell you is that 50 to 60 minutes in, the electrical current starts to affect the baby and the baby's heart rate increases. So then they say, the baby's heart rate is increased. The baby's in distress. Uh-oh, you need a C-section, which is 15K more than a regular birth.
Yeah.
America has more C-sections than any other country in the world. It's absurd. So don't get the hot water and the towels. Educate yourself through Google in other countries beyond, because they'll tell you, got to get them in, immunized. Got to do it. Really? Two kids not immunized. My son is like a truck. My son never gets sick. It's a joke. He has a file this big. My doctor's like, you know, it's not by accident. This isn't by accident. He's not been immunized. Now, I'm not saying the world shouldn't do that. I'm saying educate yourself. Listen to your intuition as a parent. Don't think the doctor is God. It's called a practice for a reason. Okay? There's also alternative medicine. And it can be called, better yet, complementary medicine. Sometime you got to get your arm cut off. Sometime you don't. Sometime you got to get your breast removed. Sometimes they leave a Sometimes they leave a scalpel in you when they, I mean, are you kidding me? Get more than one opinion. Educate yourself. There's so many horrible things on the internet. And then there's so many amazing things. There's also a God box aspect where you can get a lot more information than what your doctor's telling you in your ear. Radiation. Do you know that radiation does not cure cancer? Do you know that? Look it up. It doesn't cure cancer. It creates however much time you got left to be pretty freaking miserable. I watched my grandma die that way. I would never get it. If I get it, I won't do radiation. I'll do alternative ways. You've got a question you have to understand. The pyramid is brainwashing. Brainwashing people to be disempowered. So it's pretty scary. So my book, that was a lot. My book is really cool. My ex at the time, my son's father, had said, oh, I don't mind if that baby's making noise. I don't know if you do. Honey, I love baby noises. I have no problem.
Hey, we're good.
It's like the soundtrack of my life. It came about when we started talking about, wouldn't it be fun, you know, because I always wanted to write children's books and plant seeds that are important for them as they grow up. I was in philosophy school, esoteric school for 5 years, and studied the works of many, but, you know, the Grimm's brothers, the Lewis Carroll, Hans Christian Andersen, these are people that were writing stories for children. Well, Walt Disney stole most of them, and he homogenized them, okay? Because in its original form, Rumpelstiltskin at the end rips his body in half. The queen of this, I think the evil queen, I think they make her dance in burning hot coal shoes until she burns to death. Now, the reason why is it's that we have to be smacked for something to go in. You get in a car accident, bam, all of a sudden, right? Like, stuff starts coming in because we're going to work, we have to do this, and then we have a drink, and then we go to sleep, and then we watch TV, and it's this pattern. And the little phones that are supposed to make our life free, are you buying that? Did you find yourself working a heck of a lot more? Come on. You got to be careful. So my ex is saying to me, you can't write this book. It's hard to write a book. You can't write this, blah, blah, blah. Like, whatever. Don't tell me I can't do something. I went and read a bunch of Shel Silverstein, who I absolutely adore, always is planting really important seeds. The Giving Tree, among a book of just little short story poetry things that he does. And then I went and read one of my favorite books that Dr. Seuss did called Oh, the Places You'll Go. If If you haven't read it, check it out. Amazing book. Because it says there's good and there's bad, and it'll be, you'll soar to the top, to the high, to the best, except when you don't, because sometimes you won't, you know, and it just, it's life. And then I sat down and I started pounding it out. It came, like, the first third came out. It's like, once there was a little boy who lived in the land of no. From day to night and night to day, he'd shout it high and low. And it didn't matter how much you tried, he'd never take your hand. Because you see, this little boy, he lived in no man's land. A place he thought he had to go because it made him strong. A place where he was always right and everyone else was wrong. Okay, so then it goes on. And the first, it's like split up into thirds. The first section is, it's color, but not so bright. And it talks about him just saying no to everybody, no to his friends, no to his teacher, no, no, no. Then the second section, it gets dark because now he's alone because he's pushed everybody away. And by the, and then he discovers something very simplistic, but something very magic. The finest things come that way. And then his whole world opens up and he sees what the truth is. The publisher said the most complimenting thing. He said, the only reason I'm publishing this is not because you're an actress. It's because it has an important message, and not only for kids. We all go to no man's land. We get scared. We get, well, I'm not doing that. What do they want? What is that? So I don't live here anymore. People, they say, I live here. Okay. I go to God. I have a relationship with God. God wants a relationship with all of us. I'm not involved in religion that is, how am I trying to say it? I've lost my word for a second. I'm about non-denominational. I'm about, you know, a living God, not the one that's judging me, crucifying me, doing bad things to me, blah, blah, blah. My God doesn't have fear. My God wants every one of us to have a life that is happy and free and beautiful. But you have to ask. You got to seek. That's what works. That's what works for me. That's what works for, I found slowly but surely a king, like a kingdom. I call them kingdom people. People that get it. People that treat people the right way. People that get treated the right way. People that have the things that you think you want. Because, you know, there's some people out there that seem to have a lot of money and fame. But all money is not good money. A lot of those people you look up to, they're not such good people. So you tell a person by their work, what are they putting out? Do they help other people? What's their, you know, if you're going to look up to somebody, investigate them a little bit. Because you could end up following something that's very dark. And then you're unknowingly, you're involved in something that's dark. So I don't want to be involved in anything that's dark anymore. And I've had like some scary awakenings lately about situations and people that I didn't even know were dark. Because I was too busy thinking they were a god. I believe that the book is slowly going to, you know, we're slowly getting critical acclaim. It's slowly, but it's never my time. I'm always like, what's up, God? Come on. I can't pay my rent, you know. But it's happening though. It's happening. And I think, you know, if you're interested, check out in this next year what's going to happen. Because God has come in so strong that, I think for the first time in my life, I'm really getting on my path. And again, not organized religion. The final thing I say on that is, you know, having lived, as I said, I'm 52. Until I had made this connection and this discovery and this, like, I always knew God was there. I always knew Jesus was there. I always knew all that. But until something seriously came in because I kept acting and asking and praying, for the first time in my life, I feel love. Like, real love. Like, I feel loved. Not by my parents, not by my kid, not, right? I feel a love that is beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And it never goes away, and it's unconditional. And every mistake I continue to make is forgiven. And it's pretty astonishing. And it's a love that is for all of us. Because I'm not special. We all are special. Every person. You need to be in the public eye. How do you treat the person next to you? How do you treat the person across from you? How do you treat the person that's, you know, homeless on the street? Because the Lord didn't treat. The Lord went to those people and helped them and loved them and embraced them. And that's what I'm learning.
Learning is always good.
God, I'm learning it. Because my life has never been better. And truly, watch me this year. Watch the testimony. is going through. I wanted to stop acting. I was like, well, I don't want to do that. And he's like, sweetie, no. I didn't build you up for 33 years for you to quit.
No.
You got something to say, and now you're finally going to say it. It process. Takes time. Takes time to learn the things you got to learn. And I remember Jim Morrison said something that really was trippy. He said, I have the ear of a generation, and I don't know what to say. I said, I'm not going to be her. I got too much to say. I am not going to be Jim Morrison not knowing what to say.
Before I take up all of our time, does anybody have a question you'd like to ask? Yes, sir. Let's do this.
I'm kind of reluctant to ask this question.
Please don't be.
Because you were talking about boxing Helena.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what your recollections of working with Bill Paxton were. Because he died yesterday.
What?
Yeah, he died yesterday.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to be the bringer of that news to you.
How did he die?
It was complications for a surgery that he had.
Oh my!
He was 61.
Goodness.
I'm sorry about that, but.
Can we all just like say a prayer for a second? Lord Jesus Christ, God bless Bill. More importantly, we know he's free. He's with you. God bless his family and his children. Send them the light and the love that they need and the protection that they need now. With the Father being gone, their cover. Amen. Makes me feel like I can't tell you what it was like to work with Bill Paxton. But I'm honest. No, it's totally true. No, my God, I'd rather know. People are dropping like flies. It's unbelievable.
2017 really started off wanting to be like, I'm going to eclipse 2016. And 2016 was... I want to smack 2016. Good Lord.
God, I have to write Jennifer. Bill and I had some issues because I, playing Helena, made very, very strong choices that he didn't like. One in particular, Bill had a small role. Helena is not an easy person, okay? but what I realized about Helena was Helena had been hurt so much in her life that she was like, oh, yeah? You love me? Prove it. Prove it. Prove it. Prove it. And she was like, you know, I understood who she evolves into and becomes more vulnerable. No, but in the beginning, she scared me. She's like, okay, don't talk to Helena. She's going to like bite your head off or something. Poor Bill had to work with me when I was in pure Helena mode. And he got angry because I threw him his jacket in a scene to leave my part, and he flipped out. She can't him throw me my jacket on my desk. I said, child, I made the choice to throw your jacket. Deal with it. You can't go to the director and whine. If you're in life, you can't go. There's nobody to stop and go, cut. She threw me the jacket. That's not. Just deal with it. Throw it back at me. Do something, you know. So we were having silly power clashes. And who cares? God bless him, you know. God bless him. God bless him. God bless his family.
Yes, sir.
All through your career, even from the earliest stuff, There was sort of a quirky edge to the parts you were playing, and a lot of that has come out in comments you've made about individualism, that kind of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's affected your career, both in positive and negative ways?
It affected my career negatively, as an agent said to me once, you don't win because you don't play the game. I said, what's the game? If you walk in a room and you're passionate, everybody knows, no one can touch you, everyone wants to work with you. When you're not, everybody knows that too, and they don't give you the job. Said, well, so you're saying to me that I should go and manifest, just pretend, not manifest, but kind of create passion when I don't care? And I'm not good at doing that. Because if it touches me, it's like, whoosh, and I would do this and this, and I'm excited, and I'm passionate, and I want, and if I don't, I don't, you know. I went up for The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, and as far as I was concerned, the nanny was the hero. And she was the hero because the parents were not seeing that her child was being bullied. And she was. And she went there and said, I will rip your head off if you touch this child again. And I get that. But because I saw her as the hero, they're like, bye-bye. You crazy. I'm like, okay, I'm crazy or you are. So you go make your movie and God bless you. You know?
I've got to watch that again.
I just had to do for the most part, and sometimes I couldn't. Sometimes I had to show up and be a whore, it felt like, and do what they needed me to do because I needed to pay my bills. But for the most part, especially then when things were happening for me, like where I was getting choices, and I just be honest. So, I mean, being honest was how David Lynch wrote Audrey Horne for me. Because Audrey Horne was not in the script. There was no Audrey Horne. The pilot was called Northwest Passage. No Audrey Horne. David Lynch looks at your picture. Yes. No. Yes. Based on your picture, he's a very energetic guy. Energy connected. Not like energy that way. He decides who to bring in. He brings me in based on my picture. I had platinum blonde hair. He said I reminded him of his daughter. It was dark when I met him. Somebody had just told me before that, quickly, you know, when you go to auditions, you have to be yourself. If you're shy, be yourself. If you're kind of one of those, you know, obnoxious people, be that. If you're a jokester, be that. If you're a bitch, be that. Be who you are. Those are how the good directors that want to work with you. I'm shy when I first meet people. I was really young. I respected him. So I was kind of quiet. He asked most of the questions. I told him honestly what I thought of the script. I'm like, well, everyone's sleeping with everyone, and it's kind of like a soap opera. But, you know, because you read a script, it's very different when David Lynch puts his hand on a script. From what you read to what's there, totally different. Totally different. They came back to me, and the casting person said, well, you know, she should have been more positive and blah, blah, blah. And a week later, David is writing her a role. So for me, that was a big verification in my life of be yourself. Who you are is enough. Instead of the little girl that came from, you know, eight different fathers, you know, all these, we never had any stability. And I think early on in my career, I'd walk in, do you like me? Do you love me? Do you want to be my friend? Do you think I'm pretty? Can I work with you? You know, they'd say, excuse me, do you have any questions? And I would say, young and naive, well, how do you see her? Only wanting to fulfill whatever they thought and not realizing what I give her will make her unique. And what you give her or him, well, you know what I mean? We each have our story. It's not how do I lessen who I am to be who you want me to be. And this is in life as well. My acting teacher was a life teacher. It's who am I and what can I bring to the party? And if it fits within yours, great. And if it doesn't, God bless you. And I hope you have a great production. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Because I digress.
Yes, sir.
I just playing off that. I love with all the box metaphor, and you've got to use that that shopping cart on the aisle thing in your memoir. That's awesome.
Right?
You're writing it as we speak.
Well, they stick you in a, you know, I met really quickly, and then I'll ask you a question. What's his name once? Steven Spielberg, and he was so cool. And it was the Jurassic Park thing when he was meeting all of us, and he just said, you know, after about 20 minutes, he's like, you are not what I expected you to be. I said, oh, did you expect a siren, sex kitten, da, da, da? And he just laughed. He's like, absolutely. He said, shame on me. I did that. He goes, and I said, yeah, well, skeletons in the closet. He's like, Sherilyn, we all have a closet filled with skeletons. It doesn't matter. Just do what you do. Just keep going forward. And I was like, thank you, Mr. Spielberg. His office has E.T. on the door. You know, you're like, whoa. But yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
No, he didn't ask.
I'm sorry.
That's actually my question.
Oh, I thought, yes. Okay.
For the casual Twin Peaks viewer, you know, it's the switching of the shoes in the beginning. It's the cherry stem. But I mean, I'm a huge fan, and you've got like, you know, hours and hours of screen time in that show. And I think Audrey's one of the most fully realized characters due to your skill and other things. But like the baggage of that, right? The cherry stem and all that. I guess that's part of my question is going back to that character. And I know you can't say anything about it at all, but she was on a path, right? She's becoming in the first two seasons. And I know you can't say anything specific, but are you happy with where the journey goes with your character?
What I will say is that I was not initially, and David was open to having a wonderful, collaborative conversation with me. And then he blew it out of the water.
Okay, thank you.
And I was just like, oh, I love you. You know, he's the maestro. He's an amazing, amazing person and an amazing director. And I adore him.
Okay, yeah, because we're going to have to let you go, unfortunately. Well, last one, yes.
It's not entirely related to your acting, but as someone who would be considered successful and who has a lot of what I think are valid and strong opinions on things. You know, I'm a teenager and I have like a low self-esteem. What would you say, but any advice on getting rid of that low self-esteem, on loving myself?
The first thing I'd say is I'd love you to come to my table when we're doing pictures so that I can talk to you and we can be closer than across the room. I think it's really important to, I don't know if you believe in God or a God. Do you?
I'm open to the idea.
Well, when I look at nature and I see so many different colors and so many different animals and so many different flowers, so many different colors of green, something created all that. And it didn't create just one, created a multitude. There is enough room for every kind of beautiful flower in God's garden. And I would say that you at your age, because that's what we do at that age, are probably looking out here too much for who and what you should look like or be like. In a world, in a country especially, that glorifies youth and takes very young, pretty girls and paints them and sexualizes them and does all kinds of horrible things to them. I did not have high self-esteem at all when I was 15, 16. That I'm an actress is laughable. I mean, really. Like, never, ever would have thought any of this happens. Any of this is real. And, you know, to be a it's a little crude, but I'll be just like, I'm glad y'all love me. I'm going to go poop now. You see what I'm saying? It's connecting with the real love. It's like filling the wrong hole, okay? Be that wrong sexually by thinking, be that wrong thinking you have to look this way, dress this way, blah, blah, blah. My testimony to you would be, and I really do want you to come to my table, is once you start to find the amazing grace and beauty that is in you, because it's there, nothing will touch you. And what you'll be able to do is this pain that you've had, you'll be able to create it and put it out into the world. This is what my friend Claudia Lanau did, Rude Awakening. The worst time of her life, an addict, a junkie, everything. She made full circle and wrote an amazing show about it. My teacher taught me that horrible childhood that you had, all those things. I'm going to show you why it's a gift. Because if you can turn pain into, what's the right word? Not pleasure, but you turn that pain and you progress it. You make it into a story. You share it. You help everybody. Because a lot of people have the fatal flaw of cowardice. You don't. Here you are with no self-esteem saying something super incredibly personal. You're going to be fine. You're just where you're supposed to be right now asking those questions. For yourself. Why do we have to leave?
Because we're done. We have somebody else. 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. Cheryl's back at her table.
And I answer questions there, y'all. If you want to ask questions, I love to talk to you all. Thank you so much for coming. God bless you.
Once again, a great big thank you to Mysticon for putting on such a fantastic convention each and every year. And for Ms. Cheryl and Finn, I would just like to say I'm sorry that you and most of us had to learn about the passing of Bill Paxton that way, but I am just glad you were in a room full of people that loved you, and it was my honor to have the shoulder for you to cry on. Next, February 2018, make sure you are in Roanoke, Virginia for Mysticon, one of the greatest times you will ever have. This slice of Mysticon has been brought to you by GeekRadioDaily.com.